Welcome to the Nature-Backed podcast, where we are talking with our guests about their visions of the new green world. My name is Tarmo Virki, and in this episode, I'm talking with Joe McLeod from design agency And End.
Hey there. I hope you're enjoying the Nature-Backed podcast. I'm Merit. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Single Earth, and we're a team of more than 70 people building a nature-backed economy. And if that sounds crazy enough for you, then join us. Sign up at single.earth to be among the first to get access to our nature-backed tokens. And let's talk more on our Earth Savers Discord channel. Enjoy the show.
Welcome, Joe, to Nature-Backed.
Thank you. Thanks to you, Merit, and delighted to be here.
Joe, when I heard that you're an expert in endings, I was really fascinated. What was the beginning of the end for you? What was the beginning when you become really excited about the ends?
So it wasn't really a sort of like an inspirational moment, I guess, but it came about over almost decades. I set a project at a university I was teaching at about waste and rubbish in the world, in design school this was, and all the students went off and they came back with more stuff, like marketing stuff, like a mug that says don't waste resources or a pencil. And I didn't really have the vocabulary at the time to really grapple with that on an intellectual sort of philosophical level. You know, you could only judge it on that's more stuff, as it were. Anyway, that piqued an interest. So I'd done a small project back then around closure experiences, but then I went off, done my career. And then a few years ago, I had an opportunity to step out of the sort of rat race and my job and look again into endings. And then I started with death, which sounds crude, but it is the most powerful example we have of endings. And then I started digging into how that's related to the consumer experience industry and why we can't grapple with things like climate change and reflect upon that. And that sort of opened up into this fascinating story, which at the time, I'm going back to like 2014, more like 2016, I was really fascinated with it. And you'll hear a lot of authors say it wasn't that I wanted to write a book, it's that I had to write a book. And then I started really researching why don't we do endings in consumerism. And then, you know, like it was 2 years later I published a book about that, and that was the first book called Ends, and that came out in 2017.
When you look at the kind of the life cycle management of clients, you always talk about how keeping the clients is the most important thing, and this is the kind of the best way to save money, and acquiring new clients is so much more expensive and so on. But nobody really talks about closures. What do you think is the reason?
I think it's actually a very deep sort of sociological reason, and I find it fascinating we don't talk about it very much. So as an example, if we look at a classic sort of consumer life cycle in terms of an industry or a company presenting that to consumerism, to the consumer, we have digitized most of any industry have started really digitizing their onboarding experience. So as a consumer, I can go into their website and I sign up instantly, and identity is created in the back end and the server's really good. And then I'm off into their usage experience. So whether that means a product or a service or digital experience, I'm in there. But at the end, we haven't done by any which way that's any sort of effort in the end to do the same thing. We still have really manual systems to say goodbye to people. So a good example you can see on many cable companies in the US or around Europe is that you can sign up instantly online, but to leave, you have to endure a 1-hour sales interview with a human being. How ridiculous is this when we've got, I'm only going to put humans and waste salaries at offboarding, and I'm going to try and stop people leaving when maybe they want to leave for all sorts of other reasons than your product experience.
Yeah, I've noticed that also, that the only calls I get from the telecom people is when I've, signed off from that operator.
Yeah, exactly. So I've talked about this many times with the industry, and I get sort of two bits of feedback, and one of them is just like they really can't grapple with the idea of it, and others that have the idea's dropped in their business already, and then they've executed something. So in my second book, Endoneering, which is a bit more of a how-to book about how to do endings in consumerism and businesses, there's examples of companies which have done that. So Three in Denmark is one of the examples there. They had this sort of similar to what I'm describing. They had a whole service team which had done loads of efficiencies elsewhere in the business, had some made the business really smooth. So they got a whole call center with like helping consumers do all of these things, helping their customers do all these things. And they said, look, if we just stopped trying to talk people out of leaving, we would have so much more time on our hands. Most of the time, these people are leaving anyway, and we're just halting them. So they created a really good offboarding experience, which is in the app. It's digitized as well. And weirdly, it was interesting to hear their conversation about it, because when they released the app and the exit, I think it's called A Beautiful Exit, and they were watching the numbers, thinking everyone's going to leave. And of course, it never happened like that. There wasn't any more people leaving because they could leave easier. It's so many myths and legends around in it. It's sort of fascinating to have conversations with businesses about it. Mm.
But what's the kind of, they probably, you know, turn to you as a design agency and ask for advice how to improve the process, or how does it usually begin?
Yeah, so when I start engaging with a company, a lot of the time I have to do the talk, sort of the presentation of why are we thinking like this? Because it's so embedded in all of our cultural references around business that don't talk about the end, don't let anyone leave, you know, we're in this forever. One of my examples is that I'm married. So, you know, I have a ring on my finger, I'm married, and that ends in one of two ways, death or divorce. And in many businesses, most businesses haven't even got to that point where they're like, for example, it took Facebook 7 years to recognize that humans died. The ultimate ending that bonds all of us on Earth as much as, in fact, it bonds everyone who's been born will experience death. Mm. So we're so repulsed by the idea of, and this comes into a lot of the first book, there is a deep psychological mechanism around why we don't want to talk about death. There's and lots of aspects around that which have influenced into psychology. So there's in the both books, actually, I talk about aspects of psychology in the repulsion of death and how that's been paralyzing us to think clearly about endings in the consumer experience. So the first book takes that story way back, pre-industrial revolution, because it's a relationship with endings. So when we and I'll come forward a little bit later, but let's just talk about deep history and the plague and the Protestant uprising. So I corner the beginning of the story really in Northern Europe, because this is where the Industrial Revolution started, and this is where the beginnings of that marketing machine started, and the lack of circularity in the experience. And when the pre-plague, there was a very clear relationship with the end. Most people were a Catholic religion. They would also be able to renounce sin as they moved towards the end of their lives. So you've got a really clear relationship with the end. And then heaven was a really clear model of getting through that ending. But then the plague comes along, really disrupts the relationship with death. And then these new religions come along, Protestants being the dominant one, which dominated Northern Europe, which had, in the thesis that I've written in the first book, is they had three mechanisms which were established our rethinking of endings, which was fasting. Most religions across the world have a period in the religious calendar where you remove yourself from the abundance of life and then you reflect upon it. And we lost that in the Protestant model. So you can imagine now if we all took like a week off and really reflected about our consumerism, that would be such a powerful festival reflection point. But because and then the second one is jobs. In the eyes of God, in the Catholic religion, there was three good ones. In the Protestant religion, any job, if done well and carefully, is good in the eyes of God. However, we've all embraced that. Now we've got career paths, which we think is attached to education and blah, blah, blah. It's actually very much more fundamental than that. It gives you an identity, and then you feel like you can acquire things. And also a relationship within finance as well. So these three things then echo through centuries, and the Industrial Revolution nail on those and then build up this relationship with endings. So subsequently after that, we have a consumer experience. So if you think pre-industrial times, consumer experience was quite simple. The sort of food on the kitchen table, the waste from that food would go to the animals, the waste from the animals would go onto the land, and the abundance and harvest from the land would come back onto the kitchen table. So you had a very circularity experience. And this is really important that we think about when we talk about circularity and recycling, etc. We talk about the experience of that. And so now I'm rattling on a little bit, but I'll get to my point around, and what we've got now is this inability to think about consumerism in a bigger way, in a sort of sociological way, and particularly around endings. So an example of that with our relationship with circularity or circular economy is that we end up talking about material matter in that. So, hey, that would be better if it was made from these plastics or these type of tools. It would be great if it was manufactured in this way or efficiencies would. And we fail to talk about the consumer experience of that, because the consumer isn't experiencing circularity. There's a massive gap at the end of the consumer life cycle that halts circularity. And that's our sort of psychological relationship with endings in the consumer life cycle.
But is there something we can do about it? Is there something which could kind of, you know, not just one we at hipster startup do, but let's say kind of on a societal level?
Absolutely. So why I have to, when I go into a business, I do the talk first, is to frame it in these senses that we have to rethink the experience more. So we are really good at making consumer experiences, onboarding, usage. We can tell incredible stories. People are really educated at reading those, moving through those and understanding what we have to do at each stage. However, when we get to the end, we've all abandoned it. So the end falls to the feet of society, like municipal companies to deal with recycling, or even to the point where it is pushed onto the individual. So if you think about doing secondhand markets or upcycling, those are individual choices made by the individual to do better themselves. It's not an industrial strategy. So the industrial strategy has been left with the company that created the object. So what we need is to create consumer offboarding experiences within the consumer life cycle. And that's by getting the people that are currently doing your onboarding usage experiences to start thinking and discussing about what is the end like, what should it be like, and start reclaiming those materials more directly, or having conversations with the consumer at the end so it's more bonding at the end. I have a load of models and systems that I've done in the second book, and that so the next phase I ever do with a business, I go in, talk to them first about the idea, and then I go in with the models, tools, workshops, learnings, and I've run cohorts and lots of different training programs for companies as well.
So, in a way, you know, part of the solution would be to take the UX designers from the universities and add to their curriculum the course on endings.
Absolutely, I work with quite a few design schools, and I go in and teach them about endings, and I run different types of things. If you are listening, and if you're a university or design school, I do free talks as well, so you can get a free hour for me to like talk to your students online. But then so doing the course is great at college and university level, and opening people's minds up to thinking differently. If you think more philosophically about what we do in design courses and many business courses, is teach how to create endings, beginnings and usage periods. And that's like, when you come back from that, that's really not good.
If you look at the overall world around us, I mean, basically part of the reason why we are in the consumerism, shit we are in.
Yeah.
And part of the reason is that there has been no endings in the process of all the products we are buying, and we might not need them that longer than, very briefly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I look through a lot of the initiatives that we've done to try and improve consumerism, for example, whether it's the recycling rates or even things like I read the International Air Transport Association. They think only 1% of passengers offset their carbon emissions, for example, through voluntary programs. I think that's, if you were a business and you said we've only got 1% of our customers despite having, so this is despite, they've got 1% of people doing it, despite the legislation's in place, the service is in place, so the mechanisms are all there, and they can't close the deal. And then we see that with recycling rates. I think today or recently there was a recycling rate in the US, and it's going down quite rapidly. And in my belief, so many of the mechanisms are there, but the consumer experience isn't there. And that we get all of these initiatives, but we don't build a consumer experience around them.
Mm. I mean, some of the recycling experiences in Europe have been rather promising. I mean,
I totally agree. Yeah.
The glass bottles or things like that, where the system is in place. In some countries, it's very deep in the culture that I think over 90% of the bottles are actually recycled.
Yeah. And if we look in, for example, I live in Sweden. We have a pant scheme here. That probably means nothing to most people.
It means something, but yeah.
So what it means is that you put a small deposit on a lot of different types of products that you buy at the store, whether those be cans or bottles or glass. And that little bit of deposit stays with you in the back of your mind. It's a great complete consumer experience because it has a proper, well-designed off-boarding experience. And at the end of usage, you take that item back and you put it into a particular machine where I live, and then you get a token, and then you go and spend that back in the, so you, the whole mechanism and behind the scenes as well has all been thought through. So on every level, this is an industrial, well thought through consumer experience. But in many countries where I used to live in the UK, just no bother in dealing with the consumer offboarding experience or building those types of systems.
Very true. You mentioned the airplane offboarding, offsetting, not onboarding, offsetting experiences. It's one of the places where kind of main topic of this podcast series and the kind of endings philosophy of or teachings of you meet. How about, I mean, the 1% sounds really, really little because you kind of have those people on board. They already pay you a lot of money. And just get a little bit extra off, good conscience or whatever the airlines are these days offering as a CO2 offsets. It should, one should expect more than 1%.
I absolutely agree. I think there's such a lot of opportunities in that space. So to back up a little bit and look at the whole landscape of the consumer experience, onboarding as a consumer, I'm very accurately identified through my banking, through any loyalty programs. And I'm measured in lots of different ways in terms of what I purchase and whether that be sort of back-end digital infrastructure of what I buy online. All of these things, incredible complexity around who I am and what I'm doing. If we move to the end of the consumer life cycle in terms of impact, I can immediately relinquish myself of anything that I've done. As a consumer, I throw it in the bin, I recycle it. But there's nothing which says Joe's done this sort of carbon impact or this sort of X, Y, and Z, and it's attached to him and he has to do something about that. And when I think about that in terms of the incredible levels of identity systems I have, whether that be from banking to my identity as a citizen and getting access to education, and then on top of that, all sorts of loyalty schemes and social media onboarding to drive consumerism. And at the other end, the impact of consumerism and the ultimate consequences of carbon and climate change, there's nearly a billion people on Earth who have very little identity. According to the United Nations, they think there's nearly 1 billion people haven't got adequate identity, and one in four of those haven't had their birth dates recorded. And so when I look at the bigger picture, to think about the absence of this data at the offboarding in contrast to what it is at onboarding, there's this massive space which we haven't looked at in terms of commerce. And when I say commerce economics, there's we've only just sort of touched offboard offsetting as a piece of consumer, I guess, economic activity. But there's such enormous space there to do much, much better. So coming back to your question about offsetting at the end of some sort of experience, there's we haven't done enough there, and we haven't even scratched the surface, I think, of building experiences around this, which like can drive almost whole economies around that.
I can understand that for some of the airlines, it could be a challenge to sell to the consumers that you're bad to the environment. Maybe they will not buy the ticket in the first hand then.
I think there's actually a lot of people who want to have a better experience at it, as it were. And a thing I think is very problematic is that I travel a fair bit, I guess, you know. Let's say I travel every quarter. Every time I travel, maybe it's on a different airline. And so I don't really want to, like, I don't want to get too attached to one airline. But if I had another business which was handling all of my transactions for carbon or offsetting, then I think that would be better, because what it's really about is me as the person who's impacting it. And I need to be attached to a company which is really good at measuring and really good at really trustful in my identity. And that's essentially what banks do at the beginning of the consumer lifecycle in finance. We need a similar system at offboarding, which is about really good measurement and really good identity management. So I can offset the things and juggle the sort of impact that I'm making in a really accurate way, and a user-centric way as well, importantly.
So it sounds to me that there is plenty of opportunities for eager startups to build consumer solutions in this space.
I think that there will be. I think one of the problems is going to be how we create an identity system that's more global. Another problem with me measuring myself as not having an identity as a consumer and a person that impacts the world is that that's never measured against people in other countries. So I find it hard to accurately measure myself because I'm always an average. So I'm an average citizen of Sweden, and we're measured against average citizen of Ghana, for example. And it doesn't go that easy. I try and keep my carbon down, but I bet it's terrible. And I'm sure there's other people in Sweden who are really good at it and aren't valued either.
I mean, in Finno-Greek nations, Estonia, Finland, everybody knows that their neighbors are much worse than they are. That's probably that's probably common in other countries too, right?
Yeah, I think that's a common belief across every nation.
Yeah, that's the challenge of averages, definitely.
Yes, exactly.
You were earlier speaking about the Facebook and the kind of 7 years it took for them to understand that people die. There are few companies which have kind of started to build, you know, post-death experiences. I remember talking to one Finnish company which was working on the kind of post-death, social persona, or the logic that you can use Facebook as your, how would I say, in old movies there is sometimes people put video cassettes in the VHS player.
Yes.
For younger listeners, this is the kind of the old technology where you could tape things on. Maybe 2 years after the father of the family has died, they watch what did he wanted to say, or maybe 5 years after and so on. But they basically created the same system for Facebook or other social medias that after you pass away, you know, 2 years later or 5 years later or 10 years later, there would be still coming postings from you, kind of post-mortem?
I think it's a big issue. And I wrote about it a little bit in the second book, Endoneering. Mm. And there's a really interesting graveyard. I can't remember where it was. I think it's in an area of Russia. And a lot of very rich people there have created these gravestones that are very photographic representations of themselves, but also have consumer objects in them. And so they are very proudly, for example, gravestones that are 10 years old, very proudly holding a very old Nokia phone, for example. That's good for listeners in Finland, because we were talking about, I used to work for Nokia, sorry.
Me too.
Joke between
me too.
Us.
Me too, sorry.
Yes. So they're holding a really old Nokia phone or standing in front of a very dated car, and it looks so bad. And I think one of the things which we have difficulty with is seeing such a lot of noise in our immediate life. We see it very difficult to project a long way forward or a long way back and understand sort of sociological context from that. So, for example, I think there's a very strong tradition of making mausoleum and mortuary type artwork, but they would also avoid too many representations from the current period. So the person is identified as a facial representation, a physical representation. And what we'll end up doing, I think, when we look at creating many mortuary type experiences in the modern world with social media attached to it, is misrepresent that person as an individual, and we'll represent them through the objects and consumer objects that they have associated with themselves at the time. And so I think there's issues around that which are really difficult to grapple with. And if there is businesses that have done well in that space, I think then they deserve a lot of respect, because it's a really difficult area to look at.
I bet it's really difficult, but I can see the accountants thinking about, hey, think about those eternal monthly revenues coming from a client.
Yeah. I do know some, because obviously I've talked about endings for a while, so I bump into people, and I know of some people in who've created businesses around endings in terms of funeral stuff, not just social media stuff, but creating, and there's actually a lot of money in that world. I'm not so sure I want to get into that world, but yeah.
I mean, eventually we all will be at least clients of those companies in some way or another.
Yes.
That's a good thing.
Certainly.
It's bigger than Facebook.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's enormous. In fact, Facebook is the biggest graveyard on earth now. It's 8,000 people a day die on Facebook.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's pretty big as a funeral home.
So basically gravestones for Facebook profiles could be a business case.
Yeah, I did also example. So Facebook have mortuary pages online. And so as much as Facebook took 7 years to acknowledge that humans die, when you look at the mortuary pages, there's no user case that says we're going to remove this or shut this down. Despite maybe it never gets looked at, and despite no active users or anything, and there's no timeline to it either. These are quite rich data sources, so they have loads of archived imagery on, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's also a point where if Facebook doesn't keep its numbers up and it starts to degrade in terms of user numbers, and which is like massive now, but that's inevitable, all companies do, there's going to be a point where there's more dead people on Facebook than there is live people on Facebook, because they'll have so many mortuary pages that they have to keep running. And then Facebook will eventually die because they can't deal with the amount of dead people on Facebook.
That's a beautiful future vision. I mean, I'm sure there are kind of Facebook financial analysts who have been drawing this graph of, amount of dead people going and which year they are meeting. That would be really interesting data. If somebody has a number, do let us know. That sounds like something to, get into.
So I'd love to know that.
What's, you know, going into the 2023 soon, what's your next challenge? You're probably writing the third book on now on the beginnings, right?
Actually, not. I'm not writing a book right now. The last book came out in, 10 months ago. Right now, for the last few months, I've been building a cohort thing. So digitizing the whole training package. So that can now be, you can now sign up to that online. You can go to the andn.co website and then go from there to the cohort learning pages. And that goes on every couple of months. I run that. And that's been really good. And it's a great opportunity for people to, they go through all of the syllabus and then we meet up once a week and have these fascinating conversations about endings and consumer experience. A lot of it is around environmental stuff. We do talk also about digital endings and service endings. So it's for anyone who's interested in consumerism and building a better consumer experience, and especially around not impacting the earth. So I've been working on that, and then building up the business side, so building up the client base. So I've got, I mean, you can go on the website, but I've got some great clients already, world-class clients, car companies, big tech companies all over the world. I don't travel so much now, but most of the training's online, so I work for some of the biggest companies on earth.
The beauty of the 21st century, we can put that all on earth and at least save the climate a little bit by not traveling.
Oh, it's been amazing on that level. I think it's really helped a lot of people manage businesses as well.
Exactly. And, great. You know, we are recording this podcast over Zoom like many other podcasts I've recorded. So the technology works.
Yes, it's great.
Beautiful. Thank you, Joe, for this chat.
Thanks ever so much, Tarmo. It's been so nice to chat to you and to share the endings, engineering stuff.
Good. And I'm sure it's just the beginning for all of us.
I hope so. I hope so.
Okay, good stuff. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Join us again for the next episode. Thank you for listening. If you like the show, please give us a good rating and leave the feedback in your podcast player so others will find it too. We will be back next week. Turn on to Nature-Backed Podcast.
Are you a fan of classic cinema or a young person who wants to discover the best films of all time? Do these legendary movies still hold up?
On the Generation Film Podcast, two guys who grew up when movies dominated the culture share a great film with a panel of young movie lovers and see how it plays for today's generation.
We discuss changes in storytelling, styles, representation,
the making of each film, its initial reception, and how its meaning has changed over the years.
Join us as we explore cinema classics across generations on Generation Film.
Electric Acid. Hey there, I'm DC. I host the rock podcast Back to the Arena, The Interviews. It's about a 30-minute podcast where I talk one-on-one with a band who has released new music. You can find us on all the best podcast sites like Spotify, Apple, Google, iHeartRadio, and more. If you're a rock fan like me, subscribe today to Back to the Arena, The Interviews. Electric Acid.